SNI Digital Innovations in Learning is pleased to present another in the series of controversies in spine surgery with Nancy Epstein. This was given on March 10th, 2024. And the title of this talk and this discussion is Deep Venous Thrombosis and Pulmonary Embolism Prophylaxis in Spinal Neurosurgery. The paper is in press and will appear in Surgical Neurology International in the next 1 or 2 months. Nancy Epstein is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York in Stony Brook, and she's the editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. Nancy has had 40 years of experience in spine surgery, has extensive publications on all aspects of spine disease and spine surgery, and is a recognized expert around the world in this disease. Nancy Epstein is a professor of clinical neurosurgery at the School of Medicine at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. She's also editor-in-chief of Surgical Neurology International. Nancy has been a spine surgeon for over 40 years, has an extensive bibliography of publications on all aspects of spine disease and spine surgery, and is recognized as a world authority in this area.
Okay. Today I'm going to talk about deep venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolus prophylaxis in spinal neurosurgery. It's really effectively going to be applicable to brain surgery and probably almost any other medical as well as surgical patient that you may encounter. I was interested in this because one thing I was really worried about is with all the pressure for prophylaxis, especially chemoprophylaxis, as neurosurgeons, we're worried about postoperative hematomas or complications or wounds falling apart and things like that. So I decided the best defense is to be on the offense and to look at the literature and see what I would find. So today, that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to look at how do we recognize something like this? It's very easy if you can see a leg that looks like this, you say, oh, well, that's DVT and the patient, you know, probably going to have a PE. But if you look at the two of these studies by Finn and Haynes, overall, there are about 2 million cases of DVT per year. But look at this staggering factor, 81% are asymptomatic. That patient may have a minimally elevated white count, a low-grade fever. They may have some pain. It could be even masquerading as abdominal pain. But they're not going to just jump at you with a label. There are 100,000 fatal pulmonary emboli per year. Now, that's neurosurgery, that's all surgery, that's all medicine. But again, the emphasis here is you want to catch DVT as well as see if there's a pulmonary embolus before it's too late. What we're going to find in today's discussion is the best prophylaxis against phlebitis pulmonary embolus typically uses combined protocols. Now that can mean elastic stockings, it can mean compression stockings, and very importantly, it can be mini heparin or low molecular weight heparin. But again, what I'm going to emphasize is each of these protocols has to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis because there may be major contraindications in your patient not to use chemoprophylaxis. For example, you're not going to put a patient where you had a very complex dural repair on mini heparin postoperatively, unless you want that repair to fall apart. So anyway, an example of your compression stockings and here your low molecular weight heparin injections where, you know, typically the patients are taught how to do this. First of all, it's supposed to start on post-op day one, and many of them are being sent home with this for the next month or so. One of the best studies.
Can I ask you a question, Nancy?
Sure.
If you give them, I'm just looking at your picture there. If you give them the low molecular weight heparin into the subcutaneous tissue, does it take days to build a blood level, or does it really get a blood level very quickly?
It's a blood level very quickly. Usually, the regime is every 12 hours. Some regimes are every 8 hours. often depends on the size and the weight of the patient. But let's say you're going to bring a patient to surgery. You can have the last injection 12 hours before the surgery.
Okay, good point.
In Chibaro's study, this was 2018, they looked at or compared the compression stockings with low molecular weight heparin in about 3,000 patients. And here you can see DVT 2.3%, nearly 1% had a PE. But the best protocol was the combined protocol. They added the compression stockings plus the elastic stockings plus the low molecular weight heparin in these patients. Look how it lowered the DVT rate from 2.3 down to 0.8%, PE rate from 0.9 to 0.18%. So again, they concluded the best prophylaxis was a combination of all three, but as I'm going to emphasize again and again and again, you have to assess the comorbidities of each individual patient to determine which is the appropriate prophylaxis for that individual. So here's the outline for the lecture that I'm going to give today. And during it, you know, Jim, ask me whatever, and we'll stop and discuss the different parameters. This is supposed to be an example, basically, of a vein. And here is an embolus. And here you can see the embolus going further distally. But what we're going to look at in this DVT lecture is we're going to look at the venous anatomy just briefly, discuss the frequency of phlebitis and pulmonary embolus, look at the coagulation cascade, the symptoms of DVT and PE, risk factors associated with these, what are the appropriate diagnostic studies, what are the prophylactic regimens that are available out there, some of which, by the way, cost you very little. In other words, if you are in a country where you don't have a lot of money to spend and you can't even afford the compression stockings, you've got the elastic stockings, use them. But in addition to that, try and get that patient out of bed day zero, the day of surgery, if at all possible, mobilize them as quickly as possible, hydrate that patient, use all the conservative treatment and cheap modalities that you can use rather than just sitting back and saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to get a phlebitis because we can't afford the heparin. So we're going to go over the prophylactic regimens and finally the best recommendations. Here's an example of the anatomy of the deep venous system, and I'm going to show you how DVT can develop from below. And here, obviously, here's the heart. So it can come from below the inferior vena cava or above the heart, the superior vena cava. And here's how it starts. You have distally, you have in the calf veins, which very rarely embolize, but we're going to go over that. Then you have the proximal veins, the right femoral vein. Then you go up to the left external iliac, the right external iliac. And then superiorly, you've got the bilateral subclavian veins and the superior vena cava. These, the superior system contributes probably less than 5% of the DVT and PEs that you're going to see, the lower segment being the vast majority. There are different rates of clot propagation for calf versus proximal DVTs. And what are these? So the calf vein, the least likely to embolize to the lungs, the rate of a PE is about 1.1%. And again, you know, you're getting Dopplers of the lower extremities. They tend to be more accurate below the knee than above the knee. And it's above the knees, the iliac, the popliteal, the inferior vena cava, superior vena cava DVTs. These are more likely to embolize to your lungs. And that can happen in up to 25% of cases. So you have to be aware of that difference and what studies you're going to order and when and why.
Do we know how many people with blood clotting, if they have it in the calf, say, have it, do 85% or something like that have it already in the iliac? Or
I think it's sort of the other way around that... Well, the frequency overall of having the calf DVT is higher, significantly higher than the proximal, because it's going to basically originate distally and typically go proximally. So I think it's like, you know, 1 to 5 or something like that. 5, you know, in the calf to 1 that goes more proximally.
Okay.
Pulmonary embolism are basically, you know, clots that you're aware of that go from the pulmonary arteries and they go into the lungs. How do we coagulate platelets and red cells? I'm not going to go into this in great detail. You know, here are your platelets, here are your erythrocytes, and this is sort of the blood clot formation that you're looking at. It's going to start with platelet coagulation next to red blood cells. It forms with the clotting factor. basically a fibrin plug at the site where there's been an injury. And this is what's then going to embolize. So the platelets and the red cells form a plug. You then have an activation of the clotting factor cascade, and the fibrin strands are going to strengthen the plug. So here, your red cells, your platelets in the vein, they're going to form the thrombus and subsequently the embolus, and then it takes off and it goes more proximally. The intrinsic and the extrinsic pathways are used to treat DVT, really to determine the medications that are going to use. So here is the intrinsic pathway, and this is where the extrinsic pathway. Intrinsic pathway, this is where heparin is going to function. Extrinsic pathway, you have a combination of Coumadin and also the Eliquis, the Xarelto's, the oral medications at this point that can act on avoiding progression towards the factor 10A. The symptoms of phlebitis and pulmonary embolus, okay, here you can have the swollen leg, leg tenderness, redness, focal warmth, leg pain. Again, 80% of the time, you're not going to see any of this. The symptoms and signs of the pulmonary embolus, it can be overt chest pain, inspiration, coughing up blood, shortness of breath, low-grade fever, white count, tachycardia, confusion, low-grade confusion, or it could be absolutely nothing. Sometimes you'll put on a pulse oximeter and you'll just get a real start when you see how low the oxygenation might have fallen, especially if it falls below 90%. In Goldhaber's study, American Journal of Cardiology 2010, the main point in this study is look at the risk factors for phlebitis pulmonary embolus: obesity, immobility, older age, cardiac disease, congestive heart failure, COPD, varicose veins, cancer, birth control pills, pregnancy, major surgery, and hypercoagulation syndromes. So basically, when you see patients, too many, at least of my neurosurgical colleagues, I find, Jim, you may find this as well, they know nothing about overall medicine. They are so focused in neurosurgery that they look at the patient, they ignore the comorbidities, they make choices that are not the right choice for that patient based on the attendant comorbidities, and those patients are subsequently harmed. Here is an example of one of the biggest problems is hypercoagulation syndromes are present in about 5% of your population. Okay, they can include factor V Leiden mutation, one of the most common, the antiphospholipid antibody syndromes, and other long-term deficiency syndromes. These are very important factors, especially when you're talking about long-term prophylaxis. When you look at the recommendations for prophylaxis, period, if a patient has had a first onset event, but it's unprovoked, that means the patient was not immobilized in a plane for 12 hours, they don't have a hypercoagulation syndrome, they don't have underlying cancer, et cetera, maybe treatment is given for 3 to 6 months. And these days, one of the most common medications that's given is like an Eliquis or a factor 10A inhibitor. But indefinite continuation of anticoagulation, that may be what's recommended and needed for your patients with hypercoagulation syndromes. In fact, if you're about to do an elective operation on one of these patients, you have to be prepared and anticipate that you're going to have to start anticoagulation very, very quickly. Either that or put in an inferior vena cava filter in. Patients with persistent or recurrent or progressive DVT are going to need indefinite anticoagulation, because if you stop the medication, it's just going to recur in those patients. May have a fatal PE. And then again, the ones with the major risk factors, you know, the cancers, the morbid obesity, et cetera, and that list goes on.
So can I stop here for a minute?
Yeah.
So what you're telling me is in the universe of patients we're seeing, we take a sample out and we do surgery on them. We don't know much about their coagulation pattern because we just checked their platelets or something like that.
Right.
But in that group, there is a persistent or consistent number of people whose coagulation schemes are either abnormal or one or two standard deviations beyond the norm. And you don't know who those are. And so that's what comes up and surprises you. And what it tells you, given the testing we have beforehand, we don't pick it up. We don't know. And I think it points to what you're going to get to is Recognize it early and treat it early.
Yes, recognize it early and try and prevent it early. In other words, you know, yes, that patient with a hypercoagulation syndrome, you're going to have to anticipate starting treatment within a day or two, or they're going to be guaranteed to get disease. In the next slide, I'm going after patients who have a history of a prior DVT within the last 5 years. They're going to recur 20% of the time if they've had a first event, or almost 30% of the time if it's a second recurrence. But the high-risk patients, prior histories of DVT, if there's a family history, you know, did any of your relatives previously undergo an operation and have a pulmonary embolus? This is actually one of the problems with the so-called initial intakes, where now many physicians, especially in academic institutions, are given their requisite maybe 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And lots of times as they're walking out the door, they'll say, oh, by the way, and it's the oh, by the ways that everybody's missing these days. And that's what could be life-saving in terms of finding out what's going on in your history that could have, would have, should have been done.
So obviously, you can't start this before surgery, right? It might make it too bloody at surgery. Am I right about that?
Well, there are some patients who you could prophylactically put an IVC filter into.
Okay.
Let's say you have a patient who is morbidly obese and you're going to be doing a thoracolumbar instrument diffusion that's going to take you 9 hours. That's a patient where you could put a prophylactic IVC filter in. Or let's say you have that patient and they had a paretic right leg and you got a Doppler study preoperatively and they have a DVT already. That may be a patient also. He may require an IVC filter ahead of time. Now, postoperatively, you're still going to have to figure out when you're going to start something. But okay. You can figure out preoperatively who you're going to treat.
All right.
So these are the patients with recurrent DVT. What do they have in their histories? It was a proximal DVT. They have a history of cancer. They have hypercoagulation syndromes. Maybe they were treated previously for a DVT, but they weren't treated long enough. And there's a whole group of us out there who were doing preoperative Dopplers on patients just prophylactically, especially if there was a paresis or a paralysis of a leg or that would pick up a certain number of those patients with the already present DVT that then had to be prevented with the, you know, filter, et cetera. And again, prevention, hydration, exercise, activity, et cetera. We diagnose Dopplers basically with two major studies. And there's the Doppler that measures the blood flow in the veins, or the duplex ultrasound, which visualizes the blood flow. But actually, how are we documenting pulmonary emboli? We're no longer using basically, you know, the nuclear studies around the world. This is a CTA study for diagnosing PEs, and it was in 24 countries, 2023. And the CTA here is your pulmonary artery or pulmonary trunk, and there's your pulmonary embolus. By the way, some of these patients that you suspect may have or you know already have a DVT, if you think that there is a chance that they have a PE, you can even preoperatively obtain some of these studies and determine, does that patient's surgery have to be delayed to treat that DVT and allow that clot to resolve before you even get started? The regimens for prophylaxis, they're multiple, they're complex. The elastic stockings, they're easy enough to put on. Patient compliance can be a problem. The intermittent compression stockings, well, that requires electricity. It also requires that you have the box. Now, the problem is sometimes you would come in the morning, the compression stockings would be on the patient. There would be the box, but the box was not plugged into the wall. So they didn't have the benefit of the compression stockings working. The patient didn't have the benefit of having that kind of prevention or prophylaxis. So it takes a team of people to be on board in terms of making sure these are on. Also, if the patient gets up during the day to go for a walk, it's important to put them back on. How many times do you go past a patient's, you know, room in the ICU? Oh, well, they're out of bed, they're sitting in a chair, and they're left there for 5 or 6 hours. The compression stockings are not put back on. They're not plugged into the wall. They're just sitting ducks for a DVT. And then you have the mini heparins and the low molecular weight heparins. These are more complicated with more risk and potential complications, but also typically greater efficacy. but instances where you just don't want to use them, others where you really think you have to use them. And then a whole bunch of literature on the combined regimens and the efficacy of using a combination of these. Inferior vena cava filters have been around also for a long time. They tend to be underutilized, and they can have their own unique features and complications associated with them. And here's sort of a figurative diagram of one. So how do the elastic stockings work? They reduce the risk of DVT, basically. It reduces the cross-sectional area, faster venous flow. It reduces venous wall distension, and it can improve valve function. So in short, less pooling. You have to put the stockings on for them to be effective, but they can be effective against DVT. And again, if you're in a country where you don't have much in the way of resources, this is probably the cheapest way to try and help you reduce DVT. But if at all possible, get that patient out of bed, get them ambulating. That's your best protection. In 1986, Black et al. Looked at pneumatic compression stockings in about 500 patients at Mass General in Boston. And they found that they could reduce the risk of phlebitis to about 2.3%, but the risk of pulmonary embolus played pretty much the same at 1.1%. But they concluded that the intermittent compression stockings were pretty effective in terms of reducing DVT, but not pulmonary embolus. And here you can see, obviously, you know, quadriplegia, a patient with that severe paralysis, you know, is going to have a DVT. You can prospectively do surveillance. And if you're going to choose to treat, this was a study that back in 1996, you compared the efficacy of elastic stockings and the intermittent compression stockings. By the way, look at the difference in rates of DVT. As you would anticipate, after brain surgery, 7.7% risk because they're much more immobilized, 1.5% risk of spinal disease, but it's still pretty high. And the incidence of PE was pretty much the same in both groups. So that's what you really want to try to avoid. But it was a helpful combination. Here in brain and spine tumor patients, what Carmen pointed out is that 3 out of 4 neurosurgeons in the U.S. only used mechanical prophylaxis, meaning the compression stockings and the elastic stockings. And they steered away from the anything having to do with the heparins because they're afraid of postoperative hematomas. Because obviously, if you get a post-op hematoma acutely, perioperatively, postoperatively, you can have a paraplegic patient and that patient can die, obviously. I had looked in 2005 at 100 of my own patients having a one-level corpectomy infusion, typically, let's say, a C4-6 or a C5-7. And at that point, I was using iliac crest grafts and ABC plates. These operations took, on average, about 3.5 hours. I was immobilized. I was getting these patients out of bed day zero. Nobody was staying in bed. There was one patient who had a DVT about 6 days postoperatively. And we did a hypercoagulation workup that ended up being positive. This, by the way, shows you that the patients are not always going to be in the hospital when they develop that DVT. In fact, it's much more frequent that they're outside the hospital when these episodes occur. If they call the office and they say, I'm symptomatic A, B, C, or D, bring them in, get them studied, and don't just push everything off to the next day. Some of them have to come through your emergency room to get those Dopplers done.
Can I interrupt you for a minute? Mm-hmm. Does this mean that obviously what you're telling me is I've got a group of patients I'm operating on. There's maybe 2-3% that they're going to get a DVT. There's even if they get it, it's still going to go to the lungs. No matter what I do, 1 out of 100 is still going to have a pulmonary embolus, which is not a mild problem. So now you've got that complication at surgery. Obviously, prevention becomes the key notice. One is you got to get a good history or do some tests ahead of time. We don't do very well at that. And now after on day one after surgery, do you do ultrasounds of the legs? Besides obviously getting them out of bed, you're going to get to that. But do anticipate all this. Is there some things you can do to prevent it, like getting ultrasounds every day or something like that? Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I actually ordered Doppler studies post-op day one. and usually before the patients were discharged. And we picked up numbers of these DVTs. But believe it or not, the response of the department was they didn't want to know about it. It just prolonged the length of stay. And I was saying, well, what about the safety and health of the patient? Doesn't that come first? Well, you would think that that would be or should be the case. That's not always the case. In this instance, it was interesting. The patient had the underlying, you know, hypercoagulation syndrome, and there was nobody else in the family who had had that history. So we couldn't have anticipated that necessarily. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the reasons why you get a call from that patient post-op. They have a low-grade fever. They may have a feeling of some chest discomfort. They may be coughing. Something is awry. There's nothing better than bringing that patient in to look at the patient. Look at them, evaluate them. If you're not going to do it, at least send them to their medical physician to have them take a look at them. And if they see their medical physician and they think that there might be a DVT, you want to make sure that that Doppler is done that day, that afternoon, not just put off for the next day, because the patient could have a fatal PE between those times. And I've seen that happen.
Okay, thank you. So you got to have a high index of suspicion is what you're saying.
Yes, and your responsibility for that patient doesn't end once you get that patient out the door. I mean, how many times do we see ourselves, any of our colleagues, you know, if you can get the patient out the door, then it's somebody else's problem. Well, the answer is it's still your problem, at least for the next 90 days. It's your primary problem. And you have to be, especially in this day and age where the internists have no time, the PCPs have no time, nobody has any time to see anybody in the office anymore, practically, you have to still be that patient's physician and listen to the complaints. Don't just have your secondary, tertiary staff deal with these patients, your nurse practitioners, your PAs, your medical assistants. You know, too often you look at medical legal charts and guess who the only person who was who contacted and dealt with these patients? Medical assistants.
I can see the system as it's evolving is going to, well, go to tell some nurse practitioner to go see them and they won't even look at it.
That's right. That's right. And they won't put a hand on them. They'll just diagnose it over the phone. And
so this is a preventable disaster that's waiting to happen, and the disease is terrible. So either get them out of bed as fast as you can, or you've got to get started on something to treat this disease and prevent it.
That's right. That's right. And that takes enough personnel in the correct unit to do that.
Yeah.
Many of us had arguments where our post-op ACDFs, you know, one level ACDF, no reason that patient should be in monitored unit. I put them in monitored unit every time. Why? Because the nursing ratio was 1 to 2, 1 to 3. They'd get them out of bed. They had that pulse oximeter on. I thought that they were more carefully monitored and protected in that setting rather than just being tossed out on the floor where, you know, it might be one nurse to 20 or 30 patients, you know, especially when that other person didn't come in.
Very good recommendation that'll often be ignored.
That's correct. And it's not financially expedient, which is the other problem.
Okay, terrific.
So I also looked at 100 patients having multi-level front and back procedures, 360 procedures. These were mostly patients with ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament. And this was in 2005. And here's your classic example of OPLL, where, you know, you're doing a multi-level corpectomy infusion, then you're turning them over and doing a posterior effusion. And what did I find in these patients? These were average 9-hour procedures. By the way, in the beginning, these were sometimes 13 and 14-hour procedures. Sometimes there were also CSF leaks that one had to deal with, and that required wound peritoneal and lumboperitoneal shunts, which many of my colleagues didn't know how to do and didn't know how to treat. 7 had DVTs and 2 had PEs, and the 2 PEs were the ones with the iliac vein DVTs. This group has to be very carefully monitored. This is a group that's also typically, they were wearing a halo earlier in the course, and then they were wearing a complex cervical thoracic orthosis. But getting these patients, you know, out of bed, mobilized, it takes an entire team to do that and to do that several times a day, not just the once a day. And that's the safest thing for those patients and not sending them out to the floor.
If you go back to that one slide, what that tells you is almost 1 out of 10 patients, if you prolong surgery are in this category.
Yes, yes. And so, you have to be vigilant, and it's often extremely silent. You know, if you're just going to say, well, but, you know, I'll look at the patient who's high risk, you know, the heavy patient, you know, the one who has some kind of underlying cancer diagnosis, that's great. But you have to look at the risk factors in the other patients as well. And the fact that the immobility is one of the biggest factors of all, and that could be a problem. This is a group, by the way, because their preoperative deficits are often very severe, where preoperative Doppler studies may signal to you that that patient has an underlying DVT, and therefore you will know that you're going to have to treat that patient post-op, much less put in a filter, so that when they're prone or supine for long periods of time, they don't throw an embolus in the middle of surgery.
So if I'm adding up the risk of surgery, now I got a 1 out of 10 chance of having the patient get a DVT. Then let's say he's got a little paresis from retraction on a nerve root. Now I've got that as a complication. That's another 3% or something at surgery or more. I mean, you keep adding up these complication rates. That's why you get in trouble.
Yes, yes. On the other hand, this group of patients with OPLL had the most severe cervical myeloradiculopathy. In other words, they had preoperative MRs, and here's your CAT scan. By the way, on the CAT scan, you see this vertebral body? You see this vertebral body? You see this black area here?
Yeah.
And then you see the hyperdense area behind it? This is a classic called a double layer sign, meaning if you go anteriorly in this patient, you're going to get a massive CSF leak because there's going to be no dura. So what you try and do is you try and go anteriorly, you do whatever corpectomy you're going to do, realign them, and then try and put them into a lordotic position post-op so that and fuse them from behind so that you can take the pressure off their cord.
So now he's got a CSF leak after surgery. You want to put a drain in, or at least put him down in bed or something like that. You've just increased your risk and your problems considerably.
Well, actually, and that's such an important factor, because you're talking now, we're going to talk about low dose or low molecular weight heparin. You do not, on a patient with a complex CSF leak repair, you do not want to put these patients on your low molecular weight heparins, or their repairs are going to fall apart. I go to conferences all the time, and they're just saying, you know, I'm saying, aren't you taking this into account? Oh, no, patient's going to be fine. I said, well, no, patient's not going to be fine. So here is your, you know, example of thrombosis, subcutaneous heparin, low-dose mini heparin, 5,000 units sub-Q, Q12. Others will say it has to be Q8H. Sometimes it depends on the patient factors. You know, are they heavier individuals, et cetera? Low molecular weight heparin, same kind of thing. And here are the other regimes that you have. What's important is the heparins do not break down the clot. It allows the body to reabsorb these clots, and it inhibits the further growth and propagation of that clot. Okay, so that's important to remember. By the way, because of your comment this morning, I just thought I'd look at this. This was from the Canadian Journal of Pharmacology 2009, and Thompson basically, he's got the dalteparin and enoxaparin and all these other parins, and basically the maximum dose that you're going to have for these patients taken every day. And again, you're going to have various factors that may change the doses given, especially the weight of the patient in question. Cox looked at the incidence of decreasing DVT PE after surgery using multi-modes prophylaxis. And this is the important point here. The 992 patients where they used compressive devices, that's mechanical prophylaxis, with the chemoprophylaxis, those patients did the best. The rate of DVT was much lower in these patients, 1% versus the 2.7% you're seeing over there. Okay, number of patients was pretty comparable. Incidence of PE, pretty much the same. Incidence, interesting, of the epidural hematoma frequency was about the same in both groups, with or without the use of a mini heparin derivative. And I think many of us go into this thinking, oh, well, you know, it's only the patients on the mini heparin or the low molecular weight heparin who are going to have the clots. Well, that happens not to be the case, which is good, because it just shows you that the recommendation becomes to use the compressive devices and very much seriously consider using the chemoprophylaxis, because the data out there show, again, the risk of the epidural hematomas post-op pretty much the same, even with or without the chemoprophylaxis. And that's, remember, I showed you earlier on the paper from, you know, the early 90s that was talking about, well, 3 out of 4 neurosurgeons are still just using mechanical prophylaxis. So in this day and age, you really have to think about whether or not there are enough cons not to use chemoprophylaxis in these patients, and again, when.
That was a great slide. Now I've got DVD down to 1%, yeah, which is great, and the PE down to 0.5%. I mean, now we're getting, it's not gone, but it's a lot better.
Yes. And again, you know, vigilance, having surgeons aware. I once wrote a paper that I don't think anybody ever read except myself who wrote it. It was called "How Much Medicine Does a Spine Surgeon Need to Know to Better Care for and Treat, Spinal Patients?" And I think it was a real sleeper, and, you know, probably nobody ever read it, but it's talking about, you know, selection of patients. That acute MI patient, within 6 months, you're not going to operate on them. They've had a new stent. You're not going to stop that aspirin and Plavix for at least a year, really. Sometimes it might be half a year if you can get a special dispensation. But just knowing enough medicine to protect your patients is critical. You can't just have blinders. This is one of the best papers I saw. It was Chibaro et al. In World Neurosurgery 2018. And the best regimen, they concluded, elastic stockings plus the intermittent compression stockings plus the low molecular weight heparin. And they compared it to the previous study of elastic stockings with the low molecular weight heparin. But adding the intermittent compression stockings was better. DVT, lower rate, 0.8% versus 2.3. The incidence of PE was lower, 0.18% versus 0.9%. So the best regimen in this study was to use all three together. And it really doesn't cost you much, and it's not much of a hassle to add the compression stockings to your elastic stockings and then use your low molecular weight heparin. So I thought this was pretty cute. These two women, damn, it sure feels good to get those compression stockings off. By the way, you know, if you would go to the patient's bedside, I remember at one of the Friday spine conferences, I said, well, you know, just turn the patient over and look at their wound. You know, I don't care if you just go up to the patient and you chew bubble gum with 5 minutes, you know, talk to them, you know, examine them, do something hands-on, you know, roll them over. What does that wound look like? You know, make sure those compression stockings are on their legs and or the elastic stockings. And they couldn't believe. They said, oh, well, you know, you just have your, you know, PA or your medical student or whoever it is look at them. And the answer is no, you are still responsible. You are still so-called the captain of the ship. And your ship is definitely going to sink if you don't remain vigilant, actually. This is a study from 2023 talking about, again, advocating for using multiple regimes. And what did they found? They found that the chemoprophylaxis lowered the rate of DVT. There was only one bleed in this group, and they recommended the intermittent compression stockings, early mobilization, best post-op day zero, not just day one, and adding the chemoprophylaxis post-op day one.
So now you've really attacked the argument, which I was thinking about is, well, I don't want to start them on low molecular weight heparin, because I just don't want a chance of having bleeding. When can I start it? What you're saying from all these studies is you can start it right away, and that the chance of having a problem is extremely low.
That's exactly correct. And if during the time you have them there, in other words, what's the biggest thing that they're doing these days? Operate on the patient, send them home.
Right.
Nobody's keeping them to watch them. They go home. They don't get out of bed. They come in with a flagrant DVT, PE, wound, etc. I mean, this is one of the biggest problems that you have, is the post-operative surveillance is just going out the window because all people are caring about is getting them out the door. And this should not be the case for your complex surgical procedures. Certainly your instrumented lumbar fusions, well, you read these series, you know, post-op day one, you know, 23-hour stay. Some of them just don't even have that 23-hour stay. And some of them are are sent home, and they have a cardiopulmonary arrest from an acute PE that nobody bothered to look at or figure out.
Well, I'll go back there 1 minute. I think one of the questions people are going to say, look, I've had this extensive operation. I don't want to put him on any anticoagulant because he's going to be bleeding.
If you have a drain in place and they're draining a lot, then you're probably going to want to hold off starting any chemoprophylaxis in that patient. You're going to want to also question, is there a CSF leak that I've missed? Especially if the volume is in the hundreds and the hundreds and the hundreds and the hundreds, and it's not slowing down. So not only can you say, well, I'm going to not use any chemoprophylaxis here because the patient's bleeding a lot. Number one, you've got to take all the blood parameters, et cetera, into account. You know, when you were operating on the patient, what was your blood loss? Did you have to give platelets? Did you have to give clotting factors, et cetera? But also, is there an underlying CSF leak here that I've completely missed? And is that why the volume of fluid is so huge?
If I start them on low molecular chemoprophylaxis, and my excuse is, well, I don't want to have any more bleeding after surgery, what you've just shown us is that's not true.
That's correct.
That's not true. And if you've got other complicating factors, I've surprised a lot of residents, and their knowledge of coagulation how you coagulate and keep a dry field. Well, the answer to that was I put a bag on the end of the table or something like that and let the blood flow out. You've asked for higher risks in postoperative clot. And now with that, because you don't want to give them chemoprophylaxis, you're going to get a PE on top of that. You're just asking for trouble.
Right. And, again, you have to take one step back and say, well, was the operation that I did an open procedure or one of these minimally invasive procedures? Did I really see that I didn't get a CSF leak? Did I really take out the disc? How am I going to recognize if this patient is really neurologically worsening? Well, you have to examine them postoperatively to determine that. So often these patients are sent to, a recovery room, and the nurse is going to be discharging them later, much less maybe an anesthesia resident. And nobody's going to neurologically examine the patient to see, do they have a post-op hematoma even before they leave the door? They're leaning in favor often of not putting in a drain because they don't want them to go home with the drain, and they don't want to end up having to transfer them for an in-hospital stay because that's a bad mark against their record.
So if I'm in a country or if I'm in a part of wherever I am where I don't have access to chemoprophylaxis, you're going to get to that. But obviously you've got them out of bed. In other words, you don't have to be in a country with money to get chemoprophylaxis. These drugs, low molecular weight dextran or whatever it is, or heparin, that's available everywhere in the world. Should be, right?
Yes, pretty much.
And if it's not, then you've got to be more acutely aware and do what you're going to tell us next.
Right, right. Okay, IVC filters. Well, 80% of trauma patients especially are going to develop a DVT. The indications for filters vary. If you have just done a very complex dural repair, let's say the patient has a hypercoagulation syndrome, you are going to want to avoid your low molecular weight heparin because you're afraid your dural repair is going to fall apart. Morbid obesity. Preoperatively, these may be patients that you're going to put the filter into because you're...
Why will giving low molecular weight heparin impair the dural repair?
The clot that's going to form to try and make that a successful repair is going to lyse and disappear. So your intrinsic reparative process is going to be interrupted. And those repairs are often going to fall apart.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Prior or persistent phlebitis or pulmonary embolus, a patient who is paralyzed, the incidence of DVT is going to be huge. Long-term immobilization in the future in that paralyzed patient, hypercoagulation syndromes. So here are the different types of filters. And this is basically what it looks like on an AP view. Sometimes, by the way, you may be doing AP and lateral x-rays on a patient and you say, wait a minute, you never told me you had a filter in place. Oh yeah, doc, I had this, umpteen years ago, whatever. Okay, well, the fact that you have a filter in place can increase what's called the inferior vena cava syndrome, which I'm going to get to very shortly. But originally we had Greenfield filters. Greenfield filters, by the way, couldn't be removed, but the newer ones are retrievable. In other words, a few months after the surgery, usually 3 to 4, I'll show you a series where it was 7 months, you want to take these filters out so that they don't sit there as a coagulation nidus. This is just an example of what the trapeze filter is going to look like. It traps the clots. The clots can migrate, though, around these filters so that you can actually develop a DVT that starts, in your calves, go into iliac veins, and then goes all the way up your inferior vena cava, up to the filter, so you clog the whole thing up. You can develop swelling in the lower extremities. You can end up rupturing the inferior vena cava with this. And these are patients that may require embolectomies. So this is what you have to look for if you've put in an IVC filter. And again, you want to make sure whether or not you can end up taking that filter out. I can remember years ago where there was a patient with a circumferential operation, 360-degree surgery, and the patient developed a DVT post-op. I didn't want to anticoagulate this guy because I was afraid that he might get a post-op hematoma. One of these filters, brand new, retrievable kind of filter, was placed. It embolized to that patient's pulmonary artery. It was causing all kinds of arrhythmias. So I basically said, look, let's put the patient in the ICU. Let's try and watch that patient for a week so that I'm not worried about him becoming quadriplegic from a post-op hematoma, so that you don't have to fully heparinize him to take this out of his pulmonary artery. So a week later, they operated, split his chest open. I was there watching. They took out the inferior vena cava filter, and the patient ended up fine. But these are not just simple. Make sure the people putting them in have some experience using them, as well as retrieving them, because there are all kinds of retrieval devices. Usually they go from above to try and retrieve these. And I had used these, I placed these patients in 4 patients who developed DVT after lumbar laminectomies and instrumented fusions. By the way, the DVTs were 2 to 6 days post-op. One patient was morbidly obese. One had progressive DVT and PEs. Actually, the other 3 did. And one actually had a PE around the filter and had a hypercoagulation syndrome. But in this study, 2023, 380 IVC filters were placed. 62% were retrieved after 7 months. A lot of studies is going to be higher than that, and it's usually within a shorter period of time, because the longer the time before you try and retrieve it, the more difficult it is to retrieve. In this case, 92% of the retrievals were routine. They could do it successfully. 8% were more complicated, and only in one patient was there a minor adverse event, but no really difficult problem with that. And here, this is the IVC filter retrieval removals. You go from above, you go from below, you snare this, you snare that. This is where your interventional radiologists, come into play. And some of us have some colleagues who are just phenomenal interventionalists. And these are really life-saving procedures to be done by the ones who hopefully have the experience doing them.
That's great.
If you look at this in conclusion, in Arnold's study in CHEST 2001, he talked about missed opportunities for prevention of venous thromboembolism. And this is what I'm going to show you. He said, look, it's the failure to follow the guidelines of the American College of Chest Physicians. The most common reasons for failure of prophylaxis. I mean, anybody could guess with this. This is the kind of thing you could have an open discussion with. Maybe Dr. Ashraf might want to give us an answer to that if he's just joined us before I give him an answer. But I'll show you the answer anyway. None was used. None. No elastic compression stockings, no intermittent compression stockings, none. Okay, inadequate duration of treatment or prophylaxis. And the last is the incorrect type of prophylaxis being used. In other words, that patient with the hypercoagulation syndrome, elastic stockings, intermittent compression stockings, they're not going to do the trick. and you're going to have to start something very early postoperatively. It's going to be best to use the combined prophylaxis regimes if your patient can tolerate it. It lowered the rate of DVT in this one series to 0.8% and PE to less than 2%. So the conclusion is that the best prophylaxis against DVT combines your three protocols, the elastic stockings, the compression stockings, and your low molecular weight heparin regimes, as we showed you in the beginning of today's talk.
Let me ask you this. One thing you've talked about it, we've talked about it. What about early ambulation?
Critical. The earlier you can ambulate, the better off you're going to be. In terms of, as soon as they're awake and alert, we try and do, we were doing this in the recovery room, if possible. Just get them up, get them walking, taking a few steps, also repeating it, every hour if you could. Requires personnel to do that, especially in a post-operative care unit where they may be overwhelmed by the number of patients coming in and out. But that is the best. It's the cheapest factor. It's the most protective factor. It's the best factor.
Okay.
The best prophylaxis is to use all three if you can, but I can't emphasize enough, you have to analyze the pros and the cons for these regimes, especially the low molecular weight heparin, on a case-by-case basis. What was the operation that was done? What would the risks be for this patient rebleeding? If I put them on low molecular weight heparin, if I just did a complex dural repair and I'm just going to go over that and over that and over again, this is not going to be the patient you're going to use the low molecular weight heparin on. If that patient has a hypercoagulation syndrome and their cousin developed a DVT and died of a PE within a short period of time, et cetera, that's the patient where you're going to want to be very vigilant and start them on something as soon as possible and get them up and out of bed and get them going as soon as possible.
One of the things, when you got the references up there, I want to ask you another question. We talked about early ambulation. Now I've got a CSF leak at surgery.
Yeah.
I put him down in bed. I try to put a drain in to get this thing going and so forth. If you put him on the low molecular weight anticoagulation, the clot won't really form well, as you were talking to about it. So now everything is more complicated. You can't use the prophylaxis you want. The patient's in bed from another problem. Well, if I just open the dura and seal it well after surgery, how long do I have to wait before I start it just without having a problem?
Okay. Well, I think the main thing is the changes that have occurred in dural closure techniques. This actually might be a good topic for one of our other discussions. Number one, if you have a dural leak, and certainly if you're doing a minimally invasive endoscopic, whatever it is, do that patient a favor, open them up, do a real repair. You can do a primary sutured repair if there is enough dura to close. Use a muscle patch graft to make that watertight. Sometimes that's difficult, sometimes that's complicated. Actually, I wrote a paper with a colleague, Mark Golnick, about using anchor sutures on the surrounding bone that can help you do this. You're also going to want to use intermittent sutures. I'd use 7-0 Gore-Tex because the suture is bigger or fatter than the needle that you're using, the 7-0 needle. In addition, you're going to want to put microdural staples between those interrupted sutures. Don't use a running suture, even though there are articles that say, oh, running suture is the same as interrupted. They're not. And very importantly, these days you have not only DuraGen, which is microfibrillar collagen, but you also have different fibrin sealants. I used to seal, not DuraSeal. DuraSeal can form a big glom. It's this big gluey green stuff. It's FDA approved for this use. But then you use, after you've done your dural repair, you've got your sutures, you've got your microdural staples, you might have sewn on a patch graft. Do not use a fat graft. It's not going to work. It's going to shrink. It's not going to effectively, block it. Do your Valsalva maneuver. Make sure that that's as watertight as possible. Use your microfibrillar collagen, your DuraGen, and then create like a sandwich almost of You use a layer of your microfibrillar collagen, first putting down a layer of fibrin sealant, microfibrillar collagen, followed by the final layer of the fibrin sealant. So, and over that, you can put in a drain. So with the improved techniques for repairing the dura, many of these patients these days, we do not leave flat for 24, 48 hours like we used to. We just start getting them up. Now, it might depend on the complexity of the repair in some cases, but that's the way they're no longer treated typically with the 48 hours, head down, 10 degrees, Trendelenburg, et cetera. So that may be the safest thing to do in patients.
I'll inject a personal note here. I was found to have colon cancer. They took me into surgery, operated on me. And it's known with certain cancers that you get elevated coagulation factors.
Right.
About a week or so after surgery, I developed, and I was getting up and sober, I developed multiple pulmonary emboli.
Yeah.
And so they put me on some anticoagulation and so forth. We tried to come off 3 months later and had another small spell. So they put me on it. So my brother, wound up with a hypernephroma in the kidney, was kind of passed it off a little bit. He didn't know about that. He was just having some symptoms. He didn't want to have him followed up. Got to the hospital. Hospital had a massive PE and died.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
From a pulmonary embolus. So this is not a benign disease.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get it, it's not insignificant. So yeah. I think the point is that everybody tends to ignore it or let the nurse see it, or maybe the physician's assistant who doesn't know what they're looking for. You're just asking for trouble.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can actually remember a patient, like I just remember now, 360 front to back, flip-flop, post-op day one, shortness of their breath, hypoxia, everything else, CTA, PE protocol, big saddle embolus. And actually, we managed to stabilize her. But we had to anticoagulate her, and it was, you know, post-op day one, but there was absolutely no choice in that case. So vigilance is critical, but, you know, you can only be vigilant if you're actually seeing the patient or they're calling you. Because these days, as I said, all they're interested in is getting the patient out of the hospital. And once they're out of the hospital, they're often not sophisticated enough to realize that something bad is going on, which is probably one of the reasons why if you're going to discharge patients early, have a schedule of bringing them back routinely a day or two or three later, just to make sure that you are surveilling what's going on with them.
You do not want this problem, and you can do things to prevent it and get yourself down below the 1% like you showed in the statistics.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, terrific job. Appreciate it very much, really. Excellent. References of this paper are in the body of the paper and can be copied by taking screenshots. Of the slide which shows the references, and you can use them for your own benefit. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to help us improve our programming and also obtain CME credit. The recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. If you have questions or comments, or you want to send your CME application, send it to ausman@snidigital.org. This program is supported by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, owner of SNI and SNI Digital, and the Waymaster Corporation, producers of the Leading Gen television series, Silent Majority Speaks and Role Models, and the Medical News Network. Thank you.